Good afternoon. I'd like to begin by acknowledging some of our co-authors. Maureen Colasa is a CDC employee and has been our project officer. It's been a great big help with us. Paul Darden is our primary immunization expert at MUSC, although he's no longer at MUSC now, he's at Oklahoma. But he's been instrumental in really leading us in a lot of our work. As we do have a CDC author, I did want to read the disclaimer that the findings and conclusions are those of the authors and do not represent the official position of the CDC. Healthy People 2010 objective for immunization rates of 19 to 35 month old is 80%. And this is using the 431331 designation. The 2008 National Immunization Survey data demonstrate that the rate is currently about 76% for children in this age group. However, there is a wide variation among pediatric practices, and that's one of the things that I'll be demonstrating through my presentation. When we look at improving immunization rates in pediatric practices, it really requires a change in the way that procedures are done in the office centered around vaccine delivery. And using quality improvement methods can really facilitate this process change. These procedures should be tailored to the individual characteristics of the practice, because every practice runs things differently. And then a thorough understanding of the process of how immunizations are delivered are required, especially by the providers themselves. So the objective of this talk is to determine the extent to which pediatric practices in the SCPPRN instituted QI procedures to improve vaccination rates. We have currently have 11 practices in the network, but at the time the study was initiated, we had 9. And 6 of those chose to participate in this study, and we had an equal representation of 2 rural, 2 urban, and 2 suburban practices. We used the model for improvement by Langley as our demonstration model. And that has the 3 questions. One is, what are we trying to accomplish? That's our specific aims. And then how we know that a change is an improvement, because it's easy to make changes in a practice, but they may not either be improvement, and they actually could make things worse. So you've got to do some measures to see if that's an improvement or not. And then when you do make those changes, what changes will result in the improvement? And that's where your cycle of learning and improvement comes into play. So we use the PDSA cycles that many of you may be familiar with, but we start with the objective, the questions and predictions of why what might happen. We carry out the plan, we document the problems and start the analysis, and then we complete the analysis and compare the data to the predictions. And then when we look at the results of that, we either act on it or decide that, well, what we started to change really didn't work quite correctly, so we gotta redo it again. So it's very common to start with some ideas and simply do multiple PDSA cycles until you finally get to those changes that result in improvement. With our providers, we did a survey that looks at current immunization policies, procedures, and routines. This survey can be found on the website at musc.edu, and TIDE is Teaching Immunization Delivery Education. And then we validated the survey answers by our research staff went into the offices and observed their practices and did some chart audits to see what's really happening. We also obtained immunization data and visit data for kids age 18 to 30 months and calculated their baseline immunization rates. Most importantly, we held a quality improvement training session. This is for all the participating practices. We had the physician and the primary nurse attend for each practice, and there we discussed the model of improvement and the PDSA cycles. And we had each of the practices start to develop their own PDSA cycle of how they wanted to change or improve in their practice. With the once we had the results of the immunization rates, we went back to the practices, discussed their immunization rate findings with them, and then went over their PDSA cycles again and sort of finalized their initial approach. And during the process of the year that we had the immunization or improvement process going on, we had the practices do their own evaluation of their efforts, And we also had monthly audits by our research staff to check on their progress. Although one of those practices, we did have some difficulty achieving that, and I'll explain that later. We also had monthly conference calls among the participants, and those proved to be very important because when they started talking to each other, one practice was having a lot of difficulty with one of the procedures, and another practice had a good idea that was working for them. And so just the sharing of the ideas really worked well. So when we looked at what the providers are doing, we found that most of the time their answers to the questions agreed with what was going on in the offices, but there were a few important differences from provider perception. For example, all six practices reported that immunizations were recorded in one place in the medical record. But in fact, when we validated the results, only one practice had immunizations in one place, and the other five had various locations. Even in the electronic medical records, we found a couple of places where they could be recorded, and some of them had some different information. The other process that was really remarkably different from provider perception was that four of the practices reported that they prompt for immunizations due during sick visits, when in fact only one of the practices had a prompt for sick visits, and all the other practices prompted for the well visit only. We had each practice develop their QI team, and this is also very key, I think, in implementing change. We had the physician, the primary nurse, and the office staff. And then based on the survey responses, all practices implemented a provider prompt for immunizations at sick visits. And this is in lieu to trying to intervene with the medical record location, partly because of some of the school requirements from the health department and other immunizations that were not on the school requirement form. So just some examples of what the practices started off with. Some of them used a physical prompt because they have paper records. Two other practices had planned for using a pop-up reminder in their electronic medical record. And then one other practice uses an automatic billing system that's coupled with a paper chart. And so they had an electronic prompt generated, although it was physically placed. And then the other, the final practice had a reminder on the paper intake sheet. They had an electronic medical record, but based on the way the procedures worked, it was simpler to use a paper prompt to go along with their EMR as well. It's important to note that the practices had to revise their interventions. For example, some of the prompts were on a stamp onto the intake sheets. One of the practices tried using a paper prompt on the chart and realized that it just really wasn't working, talked with the other practice, and they switched to a stamp and they on their intake sheets, and that worked a lot better. I think the other important point there is that it's probably not as important as exactly what they did, but the fact that they looked at the process, they started to do some interventions, and then they realized in the mid-cycles it really wasn't working and they changed their interventions. So I mentioned that we had some problems with as well. One practice didn't revise any prompts, even though they were having problems getting the prompt on the chart. And the other one that was probably the most telling was an electronic medical record practice. And they were, as we started the process, the project, they were the most excited of all of them. And they were excited about having a vendor initiated prompt on their EMR. Well, it turned out that there was a fee for that, and then they had a lack of response from their vendor in trying to make the changes. And I think that he was so focused on using the EMR, which is good, they weren't really able to focus on using any other kind of system change in their office. And so they ended up really not doing much of anything with their prompting. So I want to just show a couple of examples. This actually should say paper prompt, not stamp. But this is the practice that switched to mid-cycle after talking to the other practices. When they first were using this prompt, it was a paper on the top of the medical record. Only two of them even had the prompt on the chart. So when they switched over to the stamp, they actually had a whole lot better success at using the prompt, so the change worked, and they were able to identify some that were needing immunizations in the visit. So this table goes through all the practices, and I want to just kind of emphasize a couple of things. One is that this is the chart that I talked about, the EMR record. As you can see, there was no prompts on the chart. 22 of the patients were found to be needing immunizations, and none were brought up to date on that visit. I also need to point out that this is just one assessment during the process of the year. So, you know, there's multiple, we can make multiple tables out of this, but I wanted just to give an example. This is the automatic chart, and they had 20 charts reviewed. They had 20 prompts on the chart. It was working well for them, and they did find some to bring up to date. This is the one that after the change to the stamp, they had 18 for 18. This is an example of the electronic medical record again. Because of the way the EMR was set up, once you went back to look at the charts, you couldn't tell if there was ever a prompt on there. And so we weren't able to really assess if there wasn't on the chart. But we did find that their whole process seemed to be improving, because this is a later snapshot week in their group, and they were almost all up to date, even as they assessed them. Primary care pediatrics is the resident-run pediatric clinic. We use an EMR there, but the problem with trying to use an EMR, an electronic prompt, is that the residents would go in, and they would see the patient, and then they'd come back and write their notes on the EMR later, sometimes later that evening or the next day. And so we ended up using a paper prompt on top of the EMR. It worked okay, though, because we were able to code the electronic record when the nurses did intake, and they were able to do the electronic prompt to look at the chart, and then they used a physical prompt later. And that worked well because of the 13 that were not up to date, they were able to identify 9 of them and immunize them that particular week. And then this is 20 for 20 on the other stamp. And this practice had I call him an autocratic leader. And whenever he said something was going to happen in his practice, it always did. So that's another important point about process change, is the leadership at the practice level. If he's pushing for QI, then the process is going to change. Another important thing that worked is the direct implementation by the primary nurse. All practice members need to be aware and agree that we needed a change, and it should be simple. And then if you do repetition long enough, it becomes automatic. And once it becomes automatic, then you've got change in the practice. So what really worked also was the nurse involvement and the participation. I mentioned the one practice that had the electronic prompt, but you couldn't really go back to review whether it was there or not. This nurse did an audit every week, and she was the one who printed out the daily schedules and did automatic prompting on all of them. And the other fact of that is that she left toward the end of the intervention year, but she was so committed to the process that she trained her replacement to do exactly what she had done. And after she had left, they hadn't lost a step in terms of their change in their practice. The study is limited by a convened sample of 6 practices, and so the results may not be generalizable. It does look at a wide variety of electronic medical record or paper records and just various processes, though. So we conclude that any QI procedure the providers must first understand the process that happens in their practice before they decide on an intervention, and that we have a lot of variability in how well practices will adopt QI procedures. But if you've got a fully engaged primary care provider, you're more likely to have success. And then when you've got very involved staff, that's going to be at least as effective as the clinician involvement. This project was supported by the Centers for Disease Control. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We do have some time. What questions do you have, or questions or comments do you have about either medical errors or quality improvement, perhaps stories of quality improvement or stories of medical errors and how you've corrected them?
Hi, my name is Sherilyn Kraft. I'm from Virginia. The one statement I'd like to echo, which I've heard in 3 or 4 different sessions now, is that those of us that are out in the field would like an immunization safety board, like an NTSB, so we can have a place, a clearinghouse that's safe and effective, where we can put medication, vaccine-specific errors into it so we can help fix the root cause analysis, whether it's the way packages look, whether it's just the inherent stupidness of the people that we have giving the shots, whether it's education, whether it's the busyness of the environment. But a place like the NTSB has it for transportation safety, I'd like it for vaccine safety. So if there's a voice in here that can make that happen, that's just my one statement.
Great, thanks.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
It was so much reverb.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Parencio from Baltimore County, Maryland. I guess I have more of a comment. Just want to talk a little bit about the lot numbers. When we did the H1N1, and people may have had this experience, for Baltimore County, we did one time 5,000 shots in probably about 4 hours. And at that time, we were moving, as you can imagine. And we came across lot numbers. And the lot numbers were something like ABC17EFG. And the next bottle was ABC71EFG. I missed that. And we had two people checking our lot numbers. And I missed it. And it wasn't for an outstanding nurse who was drawing up the stuff and said, it's a different lot number. And I don't know who determines the lot numbers, but I would just think that if they can understand that the persons who are giving the vaccine, we need lot numbers that are significantly different, especially with the same product, as opposed to lot numbers that are so close that you miss it. And so I guess it's just a comment, if someone can kind of bring that back to say, please change the lot numbers, the way they determine them, to make them significantly different.
Thanks.
My name is Carrie Mojan-Wallin, and I'm actually an immunization coordinator for a large private clinic. And my question is for Deborah, or really any of you that could answer, but what we found, or what we do find a lot of, is immunization errors aren't caught till like a year later when they're coming back for their next flu shot, or they're very, very rarely caught at the time that they're given, because they wouldn't be errors if they knew that they were going to do it wrong in the first place. So my question is there, do you have any ideas or tools or systems that you would recommend for ways of checking? Because what happens when we don't catch them for so long is numerous errors occur because maybe one person didn't know something and so continues to kind of do the same error. Do you have any ideas or tools that are, even with how to do reviews to keep a better handle on that?
Would that be AFIX?
That could be one.
I'm not really aware of, I mean, other than actually people reviewing charts, which I think should be happening anyway in terms of quality assurance issues in a practice setting, you know, that should be ongoing, because you're right. I mean, if somebody's making it once, they're making it again and again and again for many patients. So there should be some kind of QI in place in a practice to, you know, look for that, because it is a growing problem and it's getting more and more complex. Mm-hmm. Nathan, do you want to say something?
Yeah, well, I mean, it could, you know, it sort of relates to what Dr. Roberts was talking about as well, having a quality improvement process in place. And I think that's part of it, having some sort of audit and feedback process in place. And I think, too, knowing, you know, Dr. Wexler and the Immunization Action Coalition, there's a lot of great resources there. And I think a great starting point is knowing what some of the most common errors are, and then beginning to look for those in some sort of systematic way. I don't know if you have a comment.
And also for those in might be in the practices with you, that with maintenance of certification coming along, there's more and more emphasis for the physicians on quality improvement initiatives. And so it might be worth checking into the American Board of Pediatrics. And Imagine Family Medicine has a similar type setup now with looking at maintenance of certification and quality improvement processes. And I think somebody has a question in the back too.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah, great point.
And I have one more comment on that. As Dr. Roberts mentioned in his presentation, all these clinics said they kept their vaccine records in one place, and only one of them actually did. And I found this too when I used to work in immunization clinics. I mean, people were going through records to find a shot administered on a piece of paper in the chart. I mean, records need to be on one place in the chart. They need to be on a form. They need to be documented. If you don't have electronic medical records, they need to be in a central place in a chart. I know that AAP has a form that they sell. IAC, it's actually our second most popular piece on our website. It's called Vaccine Administration Record that you can download. But a lot of people just, you know, are not organized in terms of how to record vaccinations. And that would help a lot if you knew what was going on in your practice to review those periodically.
Next.
Hello. I would just like some clarification on giving HPV. You had said that the only two that need to be repeated if they're given by the wrong route are hepatitis B and rabies. What about HPV given into a gluteal muscle?
I'm going to have to get back to her.
That sounds like a question for Dr. Atkinson. I have never read that HPV given in the gluteal muscle, but I don't have the ACIP statements memorized, so I really don't know the answer to that, but I will find out for you if you find me later and I can get your contact. And does anyone in the room have that fact in their brains?
I know that it's a muscle, but I think that they've said to repeat it, and I guess I'd just
come up here at the end and we can get your contact information and get you the answer.
Thank you.
We'll ask the person who would know.
Hi, I'm Sharon Gresham from Augusta, Georgia, and I would just like to comment on the need to always be knowledgeable of the written policy, the written guidelines. The registries are nice and help a lot, but what we found in our clinic is that if you don't know what the written policy is, if there's an error in the person who's programming the registry, and you don't know what the written policy is, you're just going to go along with that because you don't know what the written policy is. And we saw that with hepatitis B. What was happening was if the patient had gotten four doses birth, then the patient probably got PD reset 2, 4, and 6 months. The registry was not counting the last two doses as being invalid, although the last two doses were given at less than an 8-week interval. That went on for some time, and then at some point, they recognized, hey, the registry is not reading the, it's not recognizing the fact that the last two doses were given at less than an 8-week interval, and now these kids are in a situation where they're going to end up needing a fifth dose, a booster dose of Hep B, unless you did titers. And so what we looked at and came up with a solution to try to prevent this, because we get patients from all over. A lot of the situations that we were finding were doses that were not necessarily given in our clinic, but because we're a military facility, we receive patients from all over. We looked at how could we best eliminate this, and what we did was we went to our supervisors and everything and said, hey, let's not use a PD-RICS. Let's look at switching to Pentacell, because what we found is that when you use Pentacell, you're not given the 4-month dose, which is not a needed dose in most cases anyway, unless the patient didn't get it at birth. And if you take away the PD-RICS, the hepatitis B at the dose of hepatitis B at the 4-month visit, you have less of a chance of having that conflict with the 8-week interval between your last two doses. And that has helped tremendously for us. And then by switching to Pentacell, we also realized that when the patients come back, as long as they got the birth dose of Hep B and they had a dose at 2 months, when they came back for that 4-month visit, they only needed two shots. They only needed the Pentacell and the Prevnar, they know they because the hepatitis B was given as a single antigen vaccine, and that has worked tremendously for us. But once again, it just brought home the need to know what your written policy is. Don't let your registry be your only means of being able to identify, you know, the intervals, minimum ages, right vaccine, and all.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks.
I have a comment and then a question. Talking about horror stories and administration, we have a now former VFC provider, because we did not keep them around, that when it was discovered they'd only taken temperatures in the refrigerator twice in a month, the person who discovered it hung a sign on the vaccine saying, do not use, not viable, as she was inventorying and, you know, calling the manufacturers. And the person actually, one of the nurses, walked up, moved the sign over, grabbed the vaccine, and started heading off with it. And she stopped, and she's like, it's not good. She's like, but they're due for their shot. Like, it wasn't clicking that bad vaccine is bad vaccine, hence why they are no longer with us. But part of the problem with that particular provider is with the site visits that we do, I'm from state of Indiana, sorry, State Department of Health, when we do the site visits, if the provider doesn't realize they're doing anything wrong and we only have to do, you know, 25% of our private providers, it could be 4 years before somebody's in there to say, oh, hey, wait, you haven't kept temperature since I was here 4 years ago. And so this is something we're trying to improve, but is any mandate going to come from the CDC to say you have to do your private providers just as much as our, because our health departments we do every year, and they're cream of the crop. We don't usually have a problem there, but it's in the private sector that we're like, oh, these are where the problems exist, and we're just not in those offices to catch the problem. So is that coming by chance?
Yeah, that same concern is had at CDC as well, and there is talk about and there's a lot of work being done on what the new standard should be. So,
okay.
And I imagine you'll hear more about that relatively soon.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I just have a couple comments with a lot of similar concerns, but I'm from Wisconsin. I'm fortunate enough to be here as a result of a quality improvement grant, and so we've been working on at our local health department on quality improvement methods with our immunization program. And a couple things that have been really helpful that I'd like to share, and I apologize if you're all already doing these, is when we receive vaccine, the support staff person responsible for documenting the doses received makes computer printout stickers in that exact same number with a lot number on it. And that's, for one thing, a lot of times they couldn't read our writing when they were trying to do the data input, but that's helped a lot. And we still had doses missing that we couldn't figure out how to get people to own up to. So now we've taken to making a few stickers that have a red wasted so that they can add that to the log when they're giving shots. And that's been one thing that's worked. The multi-component vaccines have been really challenging. And I don't know why, but our staff usually report an error to me within minutes of giving it. But part of it is that they all feel so badly because they're very attentive and review the record ahead of time. And so we just instituted, like, I don't know if they still do this in hospitals, I hope so, but we double check with somebody what we're planning to give, not at the refrigerator, but on paper, what the plan is for what we're going to give, because our refrigerator is so well organized and so well labeled, and that has really helped the staff feel more support and more competency in the work that they're doing. So that's been something that's worked for us. And I think that's all I have. Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks. One more.
Hi, my name is Joe Campbell. I'm from Lima, Ohio. I'm the immunization program coordinator at a federally qualified health center there. As such, as an FQHC, we have a huge transient population. We're up in Ohio. Have patients that travel or move to Alabama, back to Ohio, to Florida, to back to Alabama. Does the CDC or Dr. Wexler, do you know, is there anything on the horizon for a national database? We have the individual state databases that are good, but I would give my youngest daughter for a national database. And I like her a lot, but I see duplicate immunizations given, faulty documentations, parents don't know. And I would encourage all of us to be advocates for that national database.
Thanks. There was work a number of years ago on that topic, but it's more going toward local or state-based registries that then can connect with each other rather than one national database. But thanks.